what I'm going to attempt to do in the next hour is just run through four simple principles which hopefully give you a sense of this is what we could do in practice. So four ideas around discipleship being the principle and disciple making being the practice. Four simple ones. I'm going to go reasonably quickly. So there are numerous blogs and books that I can reference at the end in terms of kind of reading through. So rather than doing 45 minutes of talking, of information, and then you get 10 minutes at the end to think it through, I'm going to go reasonably quickly, stop, give you a chance to think, scribble some things down, talk to the person next to you, then we'll go through the next one. And the aim would be sort of roughly 10 minutes talking, 5 minutes process, 10 talk, 5 process, 10 talk. So you'll hopefully come away with a little bit more than just copious notes and some ideas, and then you've got to find another time to talk about them. That sound okay? If I talk too quickly, because I have not enough time or I get excited, just give me a wave and I'll slow down. So what we're going to look at is discipleship and disciple making. So as I said in the talk that I did however many, half an hour ago, is we're talking about skeleton and skin. So there are some key principles as skeleton. These are our disciple-making principles, but the skin is the context. So we have the content as the skeleton, these are the principles, and then we have the context as the skin, which is the practice. And so the practices need to be defined by the missional context and the community context. I can't tell you what to do in your world, and it's not my place to, and I wouldn't be as informed as you. So what I'm going to give you is four of our key principles that then it's your responsibility to say, how do I contextualize these? How do I embody these? How do I live these out in my neighborhood, my family, my workplace, my job, whatever? Because the joy and the peace that we have going on at the moment is these are principles being taught and trained in numerous different places. But when we train with Anglicans in Wellington, New Zealand, there's a different practice and outcome than when we train tribes people in Chile. They have a slightly different cultural context. Through to the suburbs of Edinburgh or mega churches in America or wherever it be. So these are principles that I'll be sharing, and I would be asking and offering you the opportunity to say, what does this look like in my life, in my leadership, in my culture and my context? So four key principles. And so we're looking at disciple making. And let's see if that works. The first one is just a simple pattern that we would give people to help them to think through how they follow the person and pattern of Jesus. So if discipleship and disciple making is becoming more like Jesus, so following the person and pattern of Jesus, doing what Jesus did, the way Jesus did it, for the reasons Jesus did it. Actually, how do we help people to begin to pattern their lives after Jesus? Not the practices, you should do this, this, and this, but some of the principles that then help them to think through, okay, if this is a key principle, what does this look like? So one of the simple ways that we do that, I'm going to hopefully draw various different parts on here that will make sense, is we would talk about the centrality and the importance of discipleship. And as we process and engage and think through this with others, what you'll generally find is discipleship is something that people agree on and don't know what is. So I believe in it, it's important, I don't really know what it is, and I don't really know how to do it. And so as we engage and train people, we would talk about four stepping stones or simple places where people need to attend to. So we would talk about leadership on top of discipleship, community engagement, and multiplication. So discipleship, leadership, community engagement, multiplication. So as we train either a leader or churches or organizations to engage in discipleship and disciple making, and this is a principle, we'd say build a discipling culture. How do you set and build a discipling culture? Helping people to own and understand the importance of being a disciple who makes disciples. As you begin to engage the Great Commission, as you engage people around being disciples who make disciples, you will, the natural byproduct of that is produce leaders. Because those disciples begin to get some of the adventurous journey or the united people. So discipling culture produces leadership. As we begin to see leaders emerge, what we're helping them to do is to identify the place or the people group that they're called to. So we're helping them say, are you good news to a place or a people group? So we begin to engage a community engagement. And so in our training, we would be talking about the continuum of temple and household that you find in the New Testament. So the gathering and scattering of the church. We won't go into that today, but I'd mention it. And then finally, multiplication. How do you actually scale, first sustain and then scale what you do? It's not a one-person ministry. It's not a one-generation ministry. We're looking for multiplication and generational growth. And so the challenge would be, how are people a living example . How are they a catalyst and coach? So a living example here on the bottom, a catalyst and coach here. How are they then a trainer and a teacher? So living example, catalyst and coach, trainer and teacher. And the reality is, what you'll find, if this is the waterline or the mark, this below the surface, in terms of leadership and discipleship, is what is oft forgotten and often missed. This is, we talk about the architecture or the foundations or the load-bearing walls. Up here, community engagement, multiplication, growth, activity, vehicles, programs, is the fixtures and fittings and the extension. And too often we put our energy and our effort into the fixtures and fittings. What does it look like? What does it feel like? How do we do it? Without enough thought for the architecture, the foundation, the load-bearing walls. Because the reality is, most people's lives look more like this. Most people's lives have activity writ large over their diary, over their headspace, their heart space, their relational space. A huge amount of organization that maintains and keeps the activity going. A small number of volunteers who are trying to hold together all the different things that are going on. And finally, survival right at the bottom underneath the heavy, heavy weight. And this would be a house built with a strong foundation. And this would be a house that only needs one good family to leave, or one key giver to leave, or one key children's worker to leave, and we're in pandemonium. We're struggling and striving to hold. So we've got lots of activity, a huge amount of energy to take the organization of that activity on, a small number of volunteers, and survival. So in all of the training and equipping we do, wherever the conversation starts, be it, how do you do church? How do you do missional communities? How do you do evangelism? How do we do multi-site? How do we do whatever? Whatever the conversation starts with, we would always pivot it to this foundation piece. And so that's the context that we're just going to look at over the next 50, 55 minutes together. Laying the foundation stone, the cornerstone in Jesus, the person and pattern of Jesus, central to all that we are and all that we do. As we're disciples who make disciples, the byproduct is leaders. As we produce leaders, there will be community both called together and hopefully an impact made. And then through that process, we're hoping to multiply and scale. So four simple principles around discipleship for you to think about. Principle number one. That sound okay?
Yep.
Great. Principle number one. We would have a very simple shape. We would take and draw that either from the life of Jesus or the life of the early church. You can pick either. But looking at what was the pattern of the life of Jesus. Because if we're to be a disciple, there's many things that we could pattern our life after, many things from culture, from history, whatever, that would speak to that and define that. How do we put Christology at the heart of all that we do? And so, very simply, and I'll give you both quickly, and then I'm going to ask you to do a little spot check. So one of the ways that we would describe it is to say the life of the early church, you can read in Acts 1 and 2, was defined by devotion. They devoted themselves to ... You know the rest of the scripture. They had all things in common. They came together, not just in heart and in voice, but with their resources, with their relationships. And you will be my witnesses. Sunny and exciting martyr, which is the word that we get martyr from. Just saying. And then finally, you will be my witnesses when my power comes upon you. So some of the marks of the early church, they were marked by devotion, devoting themselves, their relationship to God, their life for God, primary, central. All things in common, community, sacrificial living, their resources, their money, their time, their effort, pooled, shared, common. Witness. They were called to and empowered to and sent to be witnesses. And all done in the context of and the power of the Holy Spirit. The other way, even simpler, that we would communicate it is to say Jesus had three primary relationships. Up to God, into Christian community, out to the world. Up to God, into Christian community, out to the world. And all we're doing there is just giving people a simple way to pattern themselves after Christ. Not rocket science, not degree level, just a simple way of Jesus prioritized time with the Father. Yes? Yes. Jesus prioritized an investment, as I said, he walked with and worked with a 3, a 12, a 72. He wasn't a one-man band, an isolated lone gun superhero. He built and built and built into and generally spent most of his time running away from the crowds, where we generally spend most of our time running towards or wanting the crowds. And finally, he was sent to engaged, saved a broken world. There was the miraculous, but there was also the compassion. Think of the woman with bleeding, or eating and forgiving, and all the stuff that came, not just the power, but the relational side of actually being engaged in a witness. And so as we talk about how do we make disciples, one of the simple ways is, how do you pattern your life after Jesus? And what you'll find is, with every single person, and the same would be true in this room, you will generally have a sort of a right hand or a right-handedness, a natural leaning towards one. You'll have one that you're okay at, and you'll have one which is the one that always lags behind the other two. So if I throw this pen in the air, I catch it with my right hand. I don't contort my body to catch it with my weaker hand. So under pressure or given opportunity, you'll have a worldview and a wiring which will always prioritize one of these three. And there'll always be something that's sort of left behind in your peripheral vision, forgotten. And so as we engage, you can do this for individuals, you can do this for teams, you can do this for churches. So to say discipleship with two of these three, if you take out devotion, great community with great witness, that's just really good social work. It's really helpful, but it actually does good work, but you forget whose hands and feet you are and the signpost towards Jesus. You take out the witness. Wonderful, wonderful times of worship and prayer and prophecy, gathering together to eat, to commune, and those pesky non-Christians disturb our prayer meetings and we don't actually ever go and share the good news we're together. Or huge amount of spiritual zeal and passion and excitement, trying to change the world for Jesus and end up saving the world and hating each other. Because there's no community, no context. It's not sustainable or it's not relationally driven. So what I want you to do, just one, this is just one of four, just to get you thinking. Two simple things to do. Number one, what I want you to do is just do some self-reflection and just say, where am I strong, where am I weak right now? If you want to, you can give yourself a mark out of 10 on devotion, community, witness. When we do marks out of 10, or when we do marks, what we say is, this is about conviction, not condemnation. So that mark isn't, I'm a failure, I'm a success, I'm better, I'm worse. It's a point of conviction to say, actually, what do I have to give testimony for and thanks for? And actually, where have I got to stretch into more of the fullness of Christ? So if it's helpful, you can give yourself a little mark and go, actually, right now, devotion, I would be 5 out of 10. I'm busy, I'm stressed, I've missed this, I'm a little bit distracted, struggling. Community, I'm really busy with loads of different people from church, 8 out of 10, actually quite, I'm accountable, I'm encouraged, I'm serving, I'm sacrificed, I'm there. But honestly, I'm probably only 2 out of 10. I only know one non-Christian, and that's because they're my work colleague. I'm not really connected. I'm in this little Christian bubble, whatever it be. So what I'd love you to do is to just do a little snapshot reflection of yourself and your community. So your community might be your church, it might be your team, it might be your missional community. Just do a little snapshot. Where are you strong? Where are you weak? What's your sort of right now? And then I want you to think, once you've done that for yourself and your community, what would be one way to start to move into more of a sense of wholeness and more of a sense of reflecting the fullness of being a disciple? So how does a 4 become a 5? How does a 6 become a 7? What would be one or two steps to further and move forward a little bit down that? So scribble down, do a quick snapshot, and then I'm going to get you to talk to the person next to you. So not long, because we've not got long. Scribble it down. What do you think? How do you think you're doing with devotion, community, and witness as a disciple and in your community? Scribble it down nice and quick. You can do strong and weak. You can do out of 10. You can do A, B, C, D, whatever you want, just to have some sense of awareness and analysis of where you are, and then think, how do you move forward a little bit? I would talk about this in terms of Christian community and that in terms of community in the context of mission. Right, what I want you to do is just turn to the person next to you, just give them a little bit of headline of, this is where I'm at, this is what I think it might look like to grow or mature or change. Go for it. Okie doke. Let me just interrupt, keep you moving forward. Not long. We're going to, again, I'll just do one quick principle, then give you a space to reflect. My hope is at the end of the hour, you've got 4 different things that you're going to hopefully buzz around, get thinking on, put into practice. So one of the simple ways in terms of the principle of discipleship being around a life patterned around Jesus, of up to God, into Christian community, out to the world, or devotion, community, witness. So again, talking about the skeleton and skin, if this is a skeleton principle, yeah, what we have in the Celtic lands, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, is we put a Celtic skin around this. So we would talk about, how is your life in the cave, around the table, and on the road? Because they are 3 of the Celtic monastic traditions. The cave is a place of retreat, a place of you and God, God and you. Around the table, the hospitality, the welcoming, and the kind of building of family. And the road being that context of going and being sent. So you can take that skeleton and put that into the context of any culture, nationality, in terms of workplace, in terms of whatever it be. So it's just a place where you can actually start to disciple people. Pre-Christian, it's a place where you can actually help people pattern their life around Jesus before they even know him, as well as then helping everyday people to actually, this is the simple language and framework that we have to begin to follow Jesus. So if that's one, in terms of being a disciple and that's a pattern, I apologize both about the size and the legibility of my writing. One day in heaven, I will have perfect writing. Up until that day, might be a struggle. The next one I want to talk to you about is the process of disciple making. So again, just to give you one simple process that we talk about in disciple making. And so we would reference the Apostle Paul. And again, you can use this in the context of Jesus, but I'll give it you from Paul. So 1 Corinthians, and you have Paul writing and really flagging and honoring Timothy as a living example. So he's writing to the Corinthians. He says, you have many guardians, not many fathers. Many, many guardians, but not many fathers. And he goes on to say in the disciple-making piece, look at Timothy. He's an example of my way of life and my teaching. So like, he's an embodiment of my message. What I'm trying to get across to you in this letter has a face, has fingers and arms, a heartbeat. Here he is. There's a process there where Paul, as he says, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Timothy's an example of somebody who's imitated me as I imitate Christ. And so one of the pieces that we would help people think through is, that says information. So what Paul is doing in that writing, in that letter to that audience, is saying, you've got 10,000 guardians, pedagogues, the sort of nanny primary school teacher figure that the audience would have understood, that probably up to 9, 10, 11, every child would have had a pedagogue, a guardian, a nanny and a primary school teacher to teach them reading, writing, stories, scripture. All of the information that they needed to know came from that guardian. And what Paul is saying is you've got thousands of those, thousands of people that can give you the right information, but not many fathers. And he uses the word father. We would talk about spiritual parents, mothers and fathers, not many role models. Lots of guardians, not many role models. And so the role model gives the opportunity for imitation. And what the audience would have known, the Corinthian audience listening to that letter, they would have known in the fabric of their culture, a child up until 9, 10, 11 would have been with a guardian, with the pedagogue, and then the boys would have migrated and transferred to the shoulder of their father to learn the family trade, and the girls would migrate and go to the shoulder of their mother to see the running of the extended family, not the nuclear family, 2.4 kids and a Volvo, but the sort of 30, 40 kind of blood and non-blood, some commerce, some home, lots of activity. And so what the audience would have known is the transition from the teacher that gave the information to the parent that set the example. And then through that process of apprenticeship, then the child, the boy, would grow up and take a responsibility within the family business, and the girl would become a woman and take responsibility within the family. So there was a space then that after the apprenticeship where they'd imitated and seen the information in the flesh and form of another, they would move to innovation and be challenged to put it into practice themselves. So the process of information through to imitation into innovation. So Paul knew who he was writing to, knew exactly what he was doing. He was saying, this is Timothy. He's imitated me as I've imitated Christ. He's got all the right information. He's seen it made flesh in me, being on my shoulder, followed my pattern, and now he's presented to you. And so as we talk disciple making, as we train people, say, what does it look like for this process to happen? Information, imitation, to innovation. What do you want them to know? Information. What do you want them to be trained and equipped and apprenticed in? imitation. And then how do you release them to take responsibility? Innovation. Couple of challenges in that space, though. Number one, you can't imitate what you can't see. So if I begin to describe the process of disciple making and draw on this side of the board and go, I am just drawing a wonderful shape. It's got a little face in the middle. It's got ears. It's got eyes. It's a great face. You've got to join the dots, haven't you? You've got to go, well, I think it's a face. Is it square? Is it round? Who knows? And the problem with much of our discipleship is this. It says, here's the information. We're going to do a discipleship program. We're going to do a preaching series. You're going to read a book. It's a classroom, not apprenticeship model of learning. You do a class, you read a book, and hopefully, and this is the good luck, God bless you form of discipleship, as I like to call it, hopefully, you'll put it into practice yourself. So we're hidden, sharing information and hoping it lands. Which is why generally we have a church that knows that they should pray, but nobody's ever journeyed with them to help them to pray. Knows that they should engage with their community, but nobody's ever shown them how. So what Deborah is doing with Rock is producing this environment to go, I'll go first, I'll show you how to do it, come with me, and then you can do it. Not you should, but let me show you. So how much of your disciple making is you should rather than let me show you? What did Jesus do? Come follow me. Even before the calling, he said, come and see. When they were the first disciples were even checking it out. Again, if you use Jesus as an example, you don't have the Beatitudes jumping straight to the ascension. Here's how you're a little Christ. Good luck, God bless you, I'm off. But it's better, you've got the Holy Spirit, you'll be fine. He took on flesh for 3 years, showed them how to do it, gave them his shoulder, his dust, his life, his investment, and then produced them. So again, two little questions for you. Number one, who are you discipling? And are they close enough to see your life? Because you can't imitate what you can't see. Who are you discipling? And are they close enough to see your life? And then the second question is, what would it look like to apprentice them? We've fallen into the trap of the modern Western classroom and education style learning. We've lost that sense of apprenticeship. That sense of training, on-the-job training. Discipleship is on-the-job training, not in the classroom learning. So how can you open up something of your wisdom, your experience, your life to train people? So number one, who are you discipling? And are they close enough to see your life? Number two, what would it look like to disciple, train, and apprentice others? Because the challenge for us is here. Not many of us feel confident enough to say, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Especially not if you're British, that's even worse. It's like, oh, who am I? But the reality is they are imitating the Jesus in you and through you, not you. We're not looking for, it doesn't stop here. If it stopped here, that would be cloning, which is not cool or illegal. We're looking for innovation. How do they become more like Jesus as they come in and through and out of your slipstream? So again, turn to the person next to you. Just reflect verbally rather than you can write it down, but who are you discipling at the moment and are they close enough to see your life? Are you just saying you should do this, good luck, God bless you? Or actually, are you doing some of this and actually drawing them in, showing them? So who have you got? How are you discipling them? And again, second question, which is a bit more of a growth question, how could you start to apprentice them a little bit more through your lifestyle? How could they come a little bit closer, see a little bit more, you be more intentional around one thing to train and equip them in? So turn to the person next to you, have a little conversation again, go for it. Okie doke. I'm just going to give you a little space to ask a couple of questions, and then we're going to finish off with one final bit. Just two thoughts quickly before, one on this and one on this, before we go and give you a couple of questions to ask. A couple of the mistakes that we made in this space. So having done this for 20 years now, and I came to faith in and through a missional community at the university that I was in. So this is the context really that I've learned to follow Jesus, be trained and discipled in. But one of my reflections in our early years, what I experienced then we went through was in this space of the up and out and the devotion community witness, there's a challenge that every disciple is wired differently. So how do you find that balance of sort of freedom and discipline, the balance of sort of structure and spontaneity? Because some of us love a system, a plan, a process, and others love that kind of space to explore and be creative. So understanding the balance of those two, that actually as we disciple, as we work with people, there'll be some that need a very clear system to say, okay, if as a disciple I need to grow in devotion, community, witness, what is my process? And again, we would talk about what are the simple practices that you put in place to help you intentionally grow into that space. But we're looking for something that is intentional rather than something that becomes brittle or becomes too formulaic. But on the flip side, what we're not looking for is that sense of here's a principle, good luck, God bless you. You kind of work it out as you go. Because if it's too intuitive, too spontaneous, the challenge there is it becomes, usually it's one generation. It's I'm close enough to Rich or I'm close enough to Ben to probably work it out, but then when I'm trying to teach somebody else, you can't really teach something that you just go, well, it just works. So that's useless. Thanks. It just kind of happens around me. Brilliant. So it's this challenge of you. The danger that you'll have is your natural tendency, you have to embrace your own strength that you bring, and your weakness. So for those that are more, I would be more spontaneous. But the challenge is it looks like magic, or you've got people joining the dots and working out what it is. For others who are more kind of systematized, the danger is it becomes like a discipleship straitjacket where you can only do this, 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 and this. So understanding that process of how are we intentional, balancing that sort of formal and informal, spontaneous and structured, That piece is hugely significant. And I think in the early days, we made the mistake of just allowing people to kind of go into their natural space rather than balancing the two. And then in this one here, information, imitation, innovation, in one sense, this learning is really why we created 3DM 10 years ago. And have now grown and birthed into numerous different things. Because what we used to do was people would come and visit us in Sheffield and say, well, what do you do? How do you do it? How do you do missional communities? And what are these huddles? And how do you plant these, all this kind of stuff? And we'd basically just drink average coffee, draw some shapes on a napkin, tell them some stories, introduce them to some people, and then just go, good luck, God bless you, back in Grimsby, Melbourne, London, wherever, hope it works. And so the conviction for us was, this isn't a discipling, this isn't a training process. So we actually created this space, the 3DM space, to say, how do we actually apprentice and train leaders for lasting effect? And I would say, without this, as I was saying, I was talking to Deborah at lunch, you can spark something and start it, but you can't sustain it or scale it. So you can start something, you can spark it with lots of energy and charisma and personality, and things start really well. And you've got this one dynamic leader or this great couple or this really key family. But actually, this is the process that helps this innovation not just be one or two mini clones or one or two people close enough, but that process there is what actually first sustains and then scales movement. So my challenge would be, how much energy are you putting in to making disciples and producing leaders rather than just doing activities and trying to make an impact? Actually, the prioritizing of being a disciple who makes disciples who make disciples is probably one of the major reorientations that we encourage leaders to go through and to come around as they go through that process. So just a couple there in terms of our mistakes. The reality is this, there is so much more that I could say. What I want to do is just give a little bit of space, a couple of questions, and then I'm going to finish with one other principle to kind of help everyone play. So any questions just in terms of bits of clarification, or you'd like to hear more around, or examples of that? What are the questions in the room? So just to repeat the question, just so everyone hears, so 40 people, how do you go about discipling a larger number of people? If you think about Jesus, that's Jesus, thin and bald. Come on, it's an afternoon, come on. So 3, 12, 72... and crowd, in terms of his investment in relationship. And the reality is that most of us actually prioritize here and here. We generally want bigger, better, more is good. If you look at the direction of travel, Jesus is generally going this way in terms of his priority and his time. So one of the things that we would say is, you invest in the few for the benefit of the many. So actually, how do you invest in a 3 and a 12 that actually you're not investing in a 3 so that they stay a Christian clique of 3? The investment in the 3 is to benefit the 12. The investment in the 12 is to benefit the 72. And the investment in the 72 is to benefit the crowd. So there's actually a relational chain that means you are able to bring an influence to a wider number of people. Generally, what we try and do is come somewhere over here and generally do crowd control or try and get everyone excited, herd cats, and it's just not that healthy. So one of the things in terms of how do you do it, I'd be intentional about the who. So who are my 3, who are my 12, who are my 72? So I would argue, if you are a discipling leader, if I spent 2 weeks with you or a month with you, I should be able to have a good bet at this is probably the 3, the 12, the 72. Not just that you can name them, but you know them, you're investing in them. And again, imitate me as I imitate Christ. So that would be one, your investment in terms of who. The other piece would be the how. So how do you go about, which your example of 40 people in a youth group, we would use for a denomination or for a church. So all of our principles, what we're looking for is the apostolic, which is the key principle remains the same. The context just changes. So if I'm saying you should do this with 40 people, but this is really different over here and you should do this, that's not a principle that holds water. So that would be one, your who. The other piece that I would just encourage you with is to think around, not everyone of those 40 will have the same desire for change, opportunity for growth, capacity, well, all of that kind of stuff. So, and I slightly cheat and draw it the wrong way around, and you'll see why. So if this is the bell curve, and sociological principle, kind of open to change, closed to change, and up here is very open to change, and here is closed. So you'd have some of the terms of early adopters, early majority, late majority, late adopters, and across that, the vast majority are in here. So even within your 40 young people, there'll be 3, 4, 5 that are quite pioneering, love change, love difference there. There'll be probably 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 that are quite static and ready just to kind of hold what it is. And the vast majority will be somewhere in the middle, kind of reasonably open to change, reasonably close to change, somewhere in the middle. So say 7, 7, 26 in the middle, roughly. So again, most people put themselves here, right at the back, and say, how do I take everyone with me into this new piece? And it's like kind of pushing jello or jelly. So you push it, you go in, and then it bounces back and generally squashes you. you're there trying to get everyone excited to go. And the picture that we would talk about, there's two pictures. One is a marathon, one is a caterpillar. So if you think of a marathon, the oft used is a marathon, not a sprint, that kind of piece. But if you think of a 100-meter race, everyone's lined up on the start line, the gun goes off and everyone moves. In a marathon, you've got to corral either side, and there's waves of people that go off. So as you're trying to engage and disciple and train your young people, you're not trying to get everyone and say, everyone has to start here and do this. What you're actually saying is, how do I release and serve my community with the right level of challenge and encouragement and risk to help them to move? Because if it's a crazy risk, these guys at this end love it, these guys at this end leave, and these guys in the middle are traumatized quietly and may or may not come back, we'll say, depends how good your food is, whatever it is. So what you're looking for is different layers of challenge, different layers of risk, different layers of change. And so into that, the picture of the marathon is that sense of, don't start everyone here with a race, but actually the waves of leaders. So we would talk about, say, the London Marathon, 10, 15, 20 minutes for somebody to cross the start line. So the guy at the back of the marathon in the kind of monkey suit running for cancer research, who's going to take like 3 days and raise £600, by the time he gets to the front and the start line, the elite runner from the US or Great Britain or Kenya has probably covered 3 or 4 miles in the kind of 12 minutes that it took the guy in the gorilla suit to get to the start line. So they're both on the race, they've both got a number, they're both in the marathon, but actually the kind of, you don't put the elite runner at the back kind of wrestling to try and get there, and you don't put the guy in the monkey suit at the front to be trampled. So finding and thinking through, who in here, who do we have in our 40 that actually would be up for some more challenge, would be up for some more freedom, would be up for it, why don't you try this, and we're thinking through this, and then who do they connect with, again, relationally? So all of this is a kind of relational chain, not a programmatic. So it's come follow me, imitate me. It's not do the program, get the badge, get the certificate. So thinking through who you've got 3/12/72 and how you do it, more risk, more freedom, let's try something. And these guys at the back want it proved and thought through and systematized. So this end, the apostle or the kind of pioneer generally doesn't mind failing. They're quite happy. I would be quite happy failing, and I'm quite happy failing 4, 5, 6, 7 times, because it's learning, I'm getting closer, and I manage to remember time number 9 and forget the other 8 trauma and just go, this is brilliant, this worked, first time-ish. You just kind of forget the others. Whereas up here, at the back end, failure is an identity statement. Up here, failure is just learning and fun. Back here, failure is generally identity and almost terminal at points. So you're doing a disservice to your community by pushing them before you've actually given these guys a chance to work out the king. So that was a very long answer, but it does apply to different content. One more? A little bit. So I would say twofold, really. One would be, how do you try and gather them as a group so that you engage all of them, which would be collective and probably a shallow engagement relationally because you've got 150. And then it's finding ways where you can. So that would be, how do we gather the 150 here? So Jesus on the mountainside, the Beatitudes, was a gathering of all. So there's environments where you're able to say, we're all coming together. But what I would say is the piece that would hold them and then train them and then actually see something change is this environment here. So how do you actually create kind of extended families within that kind of tribe of 150? And in our language, we would talk about kind of either huddles to train leaders or missional communities to engage disciples. And so those communities could be around an interest group, could be around an age group. So within the 150, I'd be looking for the existing sort of relational networks and say, how do we, within this massive group of 150, create three or four smaller 20, 25 kind of groups around a purpose? So not just gather the kind of adventurous journey and united people. If you just go for united people, especially young people want the chance to change the world. They're not really interested in managing the system because they didn't build it. It's not interesting. Who cares? There's a big world out there. So finding a place where young people can lead, can have purpose around an interest, that will be the space where you can sort of subdivide and bring it closer, because this is the space, the 12 to 72, where that'll actually catch. And so the challenge for your youth group would be, what do we do once every term or once every kind of half term to gather everyone? But how do we actually invest in us as disciple makers being leaders of these smaller kind of youth communities of 10, 15, 20 young people? So 150, you're looking at 6 to 10 smaller communities with a purpose, with a kind of function around this age group, this activity, sport, gaming, neighborhood, whatever it be, that defines it together. I'm going to do one more, and then we'll finish up. So this one, just to give you the other one, the one that I like is the little caterpillar. So if you think about this as little people groups, what you basically start with in most churches is a little caterpillar like this. So this is your bell curve, and usually what happens is it's very, very congested. So the kind of pioneer group here is almost got somebody else sat on top of them, and they're kind of rubbed up against each other. So as you're thinking about changing and beginning to build a discipling culture, you're not trying to get everyone at the back to move forward. What you can do is leave the back still, untouched, unchallenged, and just release some space for the front to explore. So it's actually about this space and the pioneers, those first guys to go explore, because they love virgin territory exploration. So we heard this kind of slightly strange bald guy talk about this at a conference. Why don't you have a go? And what you'll have some freedom, have a go, and some discipline and accountability. Come back, we'll work about it. I'll be with you. I'm trying it too. How do we go? And at some stage, and this is where you as a leader have to serve the whole community rather than pick the bit you like, is at some stage the front actually needs to stop. And what the front then is able to do as it stops is give the back the chance to catch up. Because if you don't have the front stop, you get this sort of either stretched and elongated caterpillar and there's blood on the carpet, or you get this head dragging the back along after it. And we all know churches that have done both, don't we? Let's be honest. So it's, we'll give the pioneers free reign and they create havoc and they split the church, they stretch the church, it pops. Or we've got the back that defines what the church does, and you've got this anchor, this caterpillar kind of stuck and caught and wrestling and not moving, or trying to do kind of forward roles with the back going first. You're not going to get the back to go first. So thinking about the change, how you lead your community forward into this, is actually just as important as what you're leading your community into. And you serve your community and you take this much of your community with you if you do it in stages. So that rhythmic stretch and then solidify, stretch and then solidify, stretch and then solidify. Actually takes the whole of your community with you, not just some. One final little discipleship principle, and then I'm going to give you, again, just a little bit of chance to think and talk. One of the other pieces we use in terms of discipleship or disciple making is we use the fivefold ministry. So from Ephesians 4, so apostle, prophet, evangelist, shepherd, teacher, gifts given to us as a community for unity, fullness, and maturity. So everyone gets to play. It's a discipleship text, not a leadership text. And it's a church text, not an individual ministry text. So we need to reorientate ourselves around that. But very simply, we would talk about apostle, prophet, evangelist, shepherd, teacher. And I'm going to rush through this because we're nearly at time. So there's a whole heap more I could say and could talk to. But just to give you, again, just a simple way of thinking this through. So what we would talk about, again, that right-handedness and left-handedness. Most people, everyone would have a sort of a base ministry. So you would kind of come back to, over time, apostolic, prophetic, evangelistic, shepherd, teacher. So a sort of almost a base wiring that then you'll go through different seasons and phases in your ministry, in your life, in your circumstances, your job, be it a workplace, be it a church, will necessitate a role. So it's not that you are one and you use it as a title or an excuse. So you can't say, I'm an apostle, therefore I shouldn't love and shepherd people. Or I'm a prophet, so I'm going to listen to God and not read the word. You're not allowed to use it as an excuse, a box, a title. It's not superiority or excuse. This is your gift to bring the body to wholeness, maturity, fullness. So how do you invest who you are for the good of others, not just grow your personal story, ministry, or list of excuses? So apostle, prophet, evangelist, shepherd, teacher. And again, just thinking through people's awareness and then their activation as disciples, what we would say is the apostle, the sent one, missio, sent, will always be looking for impact and new and kind of different. So we talk about they'll always be looking at impact, or they'll always be looking at extension, what's next. So there'll be some around this, even around this room, that their worldview and their wiring is always about what's next. So I would be in that camp. The prophet, if this is about sort of future direction, the prophet, we would talk about covenant faithfulness, faithfulness to God. And we would say the prophet is pushing for integrity. A church that is faithful, disciples that are faithful, we're living our values. We're faithful to Christ in the midst of culture. The evangelist is looking for inclusion. They're the ones, as I think Deborah was saying, of looking to share the gospel, to engage the gospel, to message it into a language that non-Christians can understand. They're always the ones that say, when somebody says, wasn't it a great church service? They're the ones that go, yeah, but what the preacher talked about, 45% of it, if you weren't a Christian, you'd have no idea what he was talking about, what she was talking about. Their worldview is about those out there that don't know Jesus. And so generally, and Deborah got people to put their hands up, these are the three that are generally have got most frustrated by the current status quo of church and institution and have either been exiled or have become such an irritant that there's an unhappy kind of relationship with the status quo and that they're settled. And shepherd would be looking for investment. So building relational depth and fabric and community. And then finally, the teacher would be looking for instruction. So impact, integrity, inclusion, investment, and instruction. And so what we would say is, for a church to be healthy, should a church be missional and taking on the sentness of God? Yes. Should a church prioritize covenant faithfulness to God? Yes. Should a church be engaging in the gospel proclamation and demonstration? Yes. Should it be building a reconciled community? Yes. Should it be seeking the deep wisdom of God's truth? Yes. So a healthy church has these. A healthy disciple should have these. Now, we'll have a natural wiring, but we have to mature in all of these, if this is the person and pattern of Christ, who in the text is an ascension gift to the church for her to become all that she's called to be, if the church is called to be this and we are part of the body, we're called to be this. So what I want you to do is, again, just quickly scribble it down. What I want you to do is to think about one person, including yourself, one person in each of these that express something of part of the character of Christ in that. So who do you know who's always looking for impact and next and pushing that kind of frontier conversation? Who do you know who's always calling that depth of integrity and faithfulness? Who's always looking beyond who we've got in the room or who's on their own in the room and connecting in? Who's always looking to build and bring that fabric and that depth in terms of relationships? And who's always looking for that sense of system and training and depth and wisdom? So again, talk to the person next to you. We've not got long. Where would your natural right-handedness be? And who's around you in terms of your community and those five? Go for it. Right, I'm going to introduce you now. You ready? People are going to come talk to you. Okay, guys. Lots to say. Just trying to put a few things across your path to think about. So what we're looking for is a disciple to be able to grow and mature in all five, but we're aware that there's a natural base or wiring that they will come back to after time. So there might be phases or other in terms of circumstances or responsibilities necessitate something of a different one. So if we're looking more like Jesus, we're growing in all five, but it's helping people to understand where their natural wiring and worldview would be. So for me as an apostle, anybody that I sit next to or in front of, my worldview is how do I help release potential in them? That's always the way. It's breadth and it's multiplication and it's new and it's next. And I do want all of these other things for them, but just less, because my worldview is kind of that's where it is. My wife would be more prophetic. So for her, integrity is a huge thing. So she would say, it's wonderful we get the opportunity to go and teach and train, but how do we raise our kids and how do we live in the local community? So as a prophet, she narrows my integrity gap, because the danger for me as an apostle, if I'm not mature, is I can go and tell everyone what they should be doing and forget to do it myself. Married to a prophet, I don't have that joy and opportunity and shortfall, thankfully, because she'll say, it's brilliant, what are you going to do tomorrow with our kids in our neighborhood at the school gate? So when I get home tonight, we have missional community tomorrow. We will be in the community doing the stuff, because that's the grounding of the prophet bringing integrity. So this is getting the maximum out of your disciples and helping them to play their part as a mature body is really key. Final thing to say as we get started, and then I'm going to send you off, or Ben's going to send you off. As you start this process, one of the training pieces we talk about is moving from discipline to habit to lifestyle. So as we're journeying through this piece, final thing to say would be discipline, moving to habit, moving to lifestyle. And what I mean by that is this: discipline is intentionally doing what you've set yourself to. So my challenge to you would be, what are the one or two disciplines, the next steps, the practices you're going to take on intentionally? So discipline becomes habit. Habit is usually doing that, whatever you've set yourself to do. So most weeks, or I bounce back to it, it's in there, it's in the kind of psyche, it's in the diary, it's roughly what I do. And lifestyle is naturally, it becomes who you are, and you embody that value, or you live that pattern regularly, or it becomes part of your culture. So discipline, habit, lifestyle. Intentional, usual, natural. We all want the natural, but you have to go through the process of formation. Disciple and discipline have the same root. So how, as a disciple, do you take on disciplines that become habits, that becomes lifestyle? We naturally reflect Christ. We usually reflect Christ. we're intentionally forming ourselves to reflect Christ. And all of that is not in your power and good energy and effort. It's in the power of the Holy Spirit, allowing Christ to be formed in you and be reflected through you by putting yourself and patterning yourself after his life. Thanks, guys. Lots. I'm sorry, that was very, very quick, but at least it gets a little conversation going. David and Jenny, who are not my dad, I was joking, mum and dad, I was joking last night, just in case anyone thought they were my mum and dad. I don't want to do that to them. It reflects really badly on them if you think I'm their son. They are friends. They've lived this for 20 years, so have I. So we're going to be around, or I'm not going to be around because I'm going to talk to somebody that I promised to talk to. But David and Jen around, so you've got 20 minutes to jump around. If you want to kind of stay, ask a question, or just grab them to scribble a question down and we'll let you know and answer at a different point via Ben or Alid, then do that. Bless you guys. Great.